Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. It's been a year since the Affordable Care Act was signed into law, and soon the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on the law's constitutionality. How has the law changed your health care situation? What have been its impacts across New Mexico? We'd like to hear from you this morning. Send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org. You can also leave comments online at kunm.org. And of course, we'll take your calls live during the show. The number to call locally here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. Joining us to discuss this morning, we have Barbara Weber. She is the Executive Director of Health Action New Mexico. We also have Dr. Dean Waldman. He is a cardiologist and also a founding board member of the Rio Grande Foundation. Good morning. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Barbara, I wanted to go to you first and see if you could talk a little bit. Some aspects of this law have been implemented over the past year since it was signed into law. There are also some parts of the law that don't go into effect until 2014. So there's some things that we don't know what the impact will be yet. But I wanted to ask you if you could explain a couple of the things that have gone into effect over the past year and whether we've seen some registered impacts from that in New Mexico over the past year.
Thanks, Elaine. Actually, the law has been in effect for 2 years now, hard to believe. And during that time, there have been significant parts of it that have already been in operation for working families in New Mexico. I think some of the most dramatic have been the ability to have your young adult child stay on the parent's insurance until they're 26th, and there are over 20,000 students who are taking advantage of that and their families in New Mexico. Children can no longer be denied health insurance or exclusions or increased fees because of pre-existing conditions, and that's a tremendous peace of mind to a lot of families in New Mexico to be able to get access to health care for their children. This year, the Affordable Care Act really emphasizes wellness and prevention as a transition, and it's going to be a huge cultural change to get there. But they've already taken actions. Last January, Medicare beneficiaries begin to get their screenings free without any copays. Also, this year, although many insurance companies have already gone ahead and made that available, preventative services are without any out-of-pocket costs to consumers. And last year, over 500,000 people in New Mexico took advantage of that. So that's very exciting because we know that will help with catching things before they become dramatic issues or health issues for people when possible. Another big one for Medicare patients is that the dreaded donut hole.
Explain briefly what that is.
That when you reach a certain period, when you reach certain expenses, it's around $2,900, I believe, this year, you then are responsible
drugs, right?
For your prescription drugs. You're responsible for 100% of it. During the first year, residents in New Mexico got on Medicare with disabilities or because they're older adults got the $250 rebate. But last year, they got discounts for brand name drugs and also certain exemptions for generic drugs. And the cumulative savings to seniors and people with disabilities in New Mexico was over $9 million. So very significant.
That number is kind of stunning, $9 million. Dean, I want to go to you and ask you, one of the criticisms of this law has been that it didn't address the issue of cost in our healthcare system as a whole. So that $9 million has been subsidized, but it still is being paid out to providers, I think. Can you talk a little bit about some of the critiques of this law and the way that it is implemented and how it affects people in New Mexico?
Certainly. The biggest problem for me and basically for all the providers on our end is the fact that the vast majority of the money is going to expand and increase the bureaucracy and not to give us more doctors, more nurses, more facilities. Medicare reimbursements being cut by well over 20% means that literally you can't find a doctor who can afford to care for you. The money that is coming into our state which is sizable. The first $30 million grant was all for bureaucracy, for the IT system to expand insurance authorization and so forth. So we're hiring new bureaucrats, new regulators, new overseers. Meanwhile, as a nation, assuming 30 million people do become insured, who's going to care for them? And so the reason I am so opposed to the Affordable Care Act is that is a massive increase in spending, and that spending is not for patients. It is for the bureaucracy.
Well, and isn't this an issue in our healthcare system as a whole? Question about doctors not choosing to go into primary care because it's hard to make a living in that field of medicine. And then how does that relate to what you're talking about with money not going towards increasing the number of healthcare professionals?
That is certainly a true statement. The problem is that issue of even making a living and being able to pay your nurses and open your doors as a physician is now increasing to the specialists and so forth. So that what unfortunately the law is doing is it is taking money away from patient care and giving it to bureaucrats. And before the Affordable Care Act, this number is a stunning and fearful number. And I'll give you the reason why in 30 seconds. The over $2 trillion a year went to health care, and yet 2.3, 2.7, depending on what year you want to pick on. And of that, 40% didn't go to health care. It went into the system and then got spent on too many regulations that don't do us any good, multiple joint commission here, examinations of various hospitals, and they don't look at patient outcomes. They only look at regulatory compliance. We need to, and that's where my big thesis is, our healthcare system is not a system. We have to go back and say, well, what's the purpose of the system? The answer is, the purpose of the system is actually not even to give health care, although that's the obvious. It is to have a healthy, long-lived population. And until we can begin to say, how does the system accomplish that, and does this system do it? And the answer to the second question is clearly no. But the question is, okay, then how are we going to do it?
So you're a supporter of the larger concept of overhaul in the sense that our system.
I would actually argue, and this is my personal opinion, and my book says this very strongly, is I don't think we can overhaul this. I think we need to create a new one. I think we need to have an American system for the health and well-being of our people, 330-odd million people. And by the way, the law is strangely silent on the whole issue of illegal residents in our country. Do they get care when they come into an emergency room? Yes, they do. What's supposed to happen under the law to them? The answer is nobody knows.
Barbara, would you agree that this idea of overhaul is something that people in general agree on, that the system doesn't function well as it was before this law was implemented, and that there are still things that you would argue need to be done after this law is fully implemented anyways?
I think there's widespread agreement that the system is broken in many different ways. I think I would take exception that this law doesn't begin to address those issues and is a huge step forward. In terms of costs, for example, for the first time, we've made it mandatory that there be an 80-20 rule, which 80% of your insurance premium has to be spent on medical care, whereas in before in New Mexico, there were some places your plans were only spending 60%, especially in the individual market.
And that's related to what Dean just said about the statistic that he quoted of 40% of healthcare spending going towards non-healthcare costs within the system.
Right, and that's certainly a huge budget issue. But I think what is important for people in New Mexico is their personal budgets, and what they see are the premiums that go up and up. And for the first time, the Affordable Care Act has addressed that by saying, okay, for the first time, there's going to be legal scrutiny and oversight as to if it's justified or not. Is it going to be there's going to be participation of consumers to be able to look at that process and be a part of it and have a voice in it. I think before the Affordable Care Act, consumers were confused and probably are still confused, but there are a lot of opportunities that are going to make it much more understandable to them, both as the insurance system that they're part of and also the healthcare system. And as we go forward, and it's not going to be an overnight process. It's 17% of our economy. So that is, I agree with Dr. Waldman, that is a massive undertaking, but I think we are making huge strides forward with the Affordable Care Act for the first time.
There is actually a key point here at where the rubber meets the road, namely the doctor and the patient and the payor, that no one has addressed, and it's reality, and that's why I don't think you can tweak or modify or adjust the system. What I mean is, and I deal with this literally, fight this every day, the insurance company, whether it's government insurance or private insurance, what they want is the cheapest way to, quote, satisfy the patient. What we want is the best care, the highest quality care, and they make contracts, all of these insurance companies, whatever the cheapest is they can find. Sometimes that's perfectly adequate care for the patient. Many times, especially in my world, I'm a pediatric cardiologist, and there are very few places that do the high-quality surgery, for instance, that my patients need. And I fight, all of us fight every day with the insurance company. They say, we have a contract with X. And I say, yeah, but Y is the place where my patient needs to go to survive surgery and have the best chance to survive. Well, that's too bad. The patient's going to X, not where you think is the best. And that's a fundamental issue of who really makes the decision for the well-being of the individual person. The government makes a decision for the financial well-being of our nation, or in our case, our state. And what I care about and what we care about is the welfare of the individual patient in my office.
Dr. Dean Waldman is a cardiologist. He's also a founding board member at the Rio Grande Foundation. Barbara Weber is executive director of Health Action New Mexico. Barbara, you had a comment.
I do. I think that, and I have to say, I've also been in the medical field as a practice manager and running hospice programs and long-term care SNF facilities. So I'm well aware of the issues that Dr. Waldman is addressing. And it's true. Insurance companies have really had a say in overriding doctors and overriding and in creating a huge bureaucracy. And I think for the ACA, for the first time, addresses that and saying, no, more control goes back to the consumer. As well as to the provider. There are grievance procedures in place now that are, we're just getting ready to get the ones in place in New Mexico. That's huge. The ability of the insurance companies to deny claims is really being challenged by the Affordable Care Act. So that's a change. I also want to address the issue of illegal people with undocumented status in the country. And whether we agree with it or not, the Affordable Care Act actually states that people, the plans being offered on the exchange, cannot offer insurance to people that have undocumented status. Even if they want to buy it privately, they cannot do that.
We are talking about the Affordable Care Act, and we're taking your calls this morning. How has the law changed your healthcare situation? Have you seen impacts of the law in your experience here in New Mexico? Give us a call. The number is 277-5866 locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. We can take your emails at callinshow@kunm.org. You can also leave comments online at kunm.org. Let's go to Myra in Hemis Springs. Good morning, Myra. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to explain that I'm hoping the Affordable Care Act will change my situation. I'm a cancer survivor. I'm less than 10 years out of the experience. And in New Mexico, insurance companies are allowed to exclude me from individual policies. I do not work where I get benefits, and so I can't be part of a group policy. But I can be excluded from an individual policy, So that leaves me the insurance pool, the high-risk pool, and it's extremely expensive. And paying for that plus 20% of the health care that I do need, and I'm not experiencing anything relative to cancer anymore, and I haven't for years.
Congratulations, Myra.
But I still have to follow up, is taking 25% of my less than $24,000 a year income. And we're now facing a 6.9% increase in the pool. And I don't know what people do. I mean, it becomes unaffordable at a point where, and you just go without. And then what does that cost society? So there's my point.
Myra, thank you for that that call, and congratulations on surviving cancer. In 2014, no one can be excluded at any point anymore for pre-existing conditions. The insurance pool that you mentioned is a bridge. It's not the total answer, which is why in 2014 that'll go away. Another important thing for people who a law that is already in effect is that the annual caps have gone away for insurance
net amount paid,
and that is huge for people, because if you certainly if you've got a pediatric congenital heart defect, if you have any life-threatening situation, you blow through some of those lifetime limits very quickly. And so that has been a huge source of peace of mind to people, I think, and giving people a lot more control back. We do know that currently the major source of personal bankruptcy are medical expenses. So this begins eating a hole in that medical debt situation that we all face.
Dean, your thoughts?
Oh, I don't think there's a person in the nation, but we feel on the healthcare side, on the practice side, the whole issue of pre-existing condition is bizarre. I mean, the fact is everybody on earth has a pre-existing condition.
Death.
It's called death, ultimately.
Right.
And so that was bizarre at the front end. I'd like people to consider, very much Barbara including, I'd like people to consider that the whole system of cheapest is best is the wrong way to design such a system. The system should be rewarding those outcomes that patients want. Well, what do patients want? They want to live a long time, and they want to be healthy while they're living.
And yet, isn't there research that has shown that when people are given a choice, people will choose treatments, tests, and things that are perhaps excessive out of the desire to do above and beyond what's necessary? And does that mean then that individuals who are making their choices in a context where healthcare providers are perhaps profiting or continuing their business based on the number of tests or whatever,
exactly,
does that provide an impetus for an overselling of healthcare that is kind of the opposite end of the spectrum as cheaper than cheaper
sure
is best?
And the answer is you have to start looking at rewarding those things, not performance by a doctor, but outcomes for the patient. I should get rewarded when my baby, A, survives surgery, B, is healthy at the end of surgery, C, gets out of the hospital quickly. Those are the things I should be rewarded for, not the fact that I operated on the child.
Right. Let me take a quick break, and we'll come back with your comments and calls. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act this morning on the KUNM Call-In Show. We've got a couple lines open right now. The number to call is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Celebrate the life and legacy of labor leader and civil rights activist Cesar Chavez Saturday, March 31st at 10:30 a.m. with a March for Justice at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, followed by a festival from noon to 3 p.m. featuring food, kids' activities, cultural performances, and a concert by Ivan Ulibarri y Café Mocha and La Banda Tierra Manzanera. For more information, call 246-2261 or visit cesarchaveznm.org. A message from the tax-exempt Recuerda a Cesar Chavez Committee.
What does healthcare reform do for women? When a majority of women want and use birth control, why are we having a national debate about insurance coverage of contraception? Hear from the National Women's Law Center's senior health policy analyst, Anna Benio, as she gives us the scoop on benefits impacting women. Join us this Friday morning for Women's Health Today at 8 a.m. right here on KUNM.
I'm Elaine Baumgartel. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court will hear arguments on its constitutionality next week. KUNM will bring you special NPR coverage of what's at stake in the healthcare overhaul, as well as coverage of the arguments presented to the U.S. Supreme Court justices. That's next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m. right after All Things Considered. Joining us this morning to discuss the Affordable Care Act, Dr. Dean Waldman. He's a cardiologist and founding board member of the Rio Grande Foundation. Also, Barbara Weber, executive director of Health Action New Mexico. And I want to take a few calls and then come back to the panel. Let's go to Nancy in Taos. Good morning, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. This is an absolutely terrific show. On Friday evening, I was finally admitted to Holy Cross Hospital. I went in to have an x-ray in the morning because of an asthma attack. It turned out to be that it was walking pneumonia. And it took them until the evening to admit me. The people are wonderful. My care was supreme, the bedside care. But when I finally got there into my bed on Friday evening, I didn't get the CAT scan until, I think I gotten the CAT scan that evening. And I've been in asthmatic since I was 10. And I'm 79 years old. That's important. And so I was there Friday. I was on Saturday. The time that it took to wait for the results from the examinations was really, really difficult and anxiety-making. And I really felt that there was tremendous pressure being put on the doctors to then suddenly get the results, get me out of there. And I knew my rights with Medicare. I've been paying Medicare for 18 years, and I've been in that hospital only once before. I pay Medicare, and I also my daughter pays it for me. I'm under poverty line. And the Medicare man came to my bed, and I stood by my rights. And by the way, the people there, the caretakers, were helpful. And I said that I wanted to stand my rights. They helped me. But then when the Medicare person came and smiled blandly at me, he handed me a paper, and on the paper it said, yes, I could stand by my rights, but if I didn't go home the next day, you know, and then the doctors are pressed, and they present their view of this situation, of my situation, which was a little complicated. I didn't know I had walking pneumonia, so I got heart problems, and so they're pressed.
So Nancy, then, I want to let you know that
this man says to me, okay, he hands me a paper, I sign the paper, I look at it, and I'm relieved, and then I'm told that if I stand by my rights, I will have to pay the legal fees, I will have to pay the hospital until my case is heard, and then if my case is heard and won, I will have to still pay the legal fees of Medicare for my case. And I have no money. That's a shocking thing to eat. And it's just, if you're sick, like the 84-year-old woman in the bed next to me, and you don't read the paper, don't have somebody to be beside you.
Well, so Nancy, both Barbara in the studio and Dean, Barbara was nodding her head as you were telling the story. Dean kind of shook his head there at a moment when you were explaining some of the experiences you had. Barbara, what was making you nod your head? Respond a little bit to Nancy's call.
I think the putting a patient under stress when they've already have an illness that they're working on is unconscionable. And I think whether it's Medicare or more likely what we see, it's the private insurance companies who have the control without redress in many cases. And that's really being addressed. And as a consumer advocacy group, we're really going to stay on top of that. I think the impetus on getting people out, one of the things that will be now part of the hospital payment process is that they'll no longer have frequently people are taken out of the hospital before they're ready to go without instructions, particularly in a sudden acute situation like Nancy's describing, and they're back in the hospital.
Does the Affordable Care Act address this situation?
Yep. One of the things Affordable Care Act says now, you're not going to be paid for your readmissions. You're going to have to do the case right in the beginning, and certainly stressing out a patient when they're ill is not part of the healing process and keeping people out of the hospital.
Let's take another call. Mark in Albuquerque. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air. It looks like Mark might not have been able to wait until we got to his call. We also got an email this morning from Judith, and her question, she says, if a veteran is currently using the VA system, how does the Affordable Health Care Act apply to the VA healthcare system? Is either of you familiar with the?
The VA system operates kind of on its own. I think one of the issues that comes up in New Mexico is that a lot of people veterans are in rural areas where it's not as easy to access the VA benefits, and so they end up coming to the community hospitals and to the community system. So that's an issue I think that has to be addressed. It's not directly addressed by healthcare reform because, as I say, the VA operates as a separate silo, I would say.
I can respond to that in a very broad way, but an important way, which is also relevant to the previous caller. The problem really fundamentally is we have, I personally believe, wonderful people as caregivers in this country, doctors, nurses, who really, really are well-trained and give a damn. And we have a terrible system that does not allow them to do what they want to do for the welfare of a patient. Example, Secretary Gates, when he was secretary, have testified before the Congress when he was asking for money for the prosecution of the Iraq War, and they told him to cut his allocation by something like 25% or request. And he turned around and said, I have a choice. Either I cut benefits for my military people, 10 million people that we cover, or I cut armor for the Humvees and fighter jets. Tell me what I should cut. Well, as long as we have a system where we have to actually make that decision and spend all this money on bureaucracy that needs to be spent on people, we're in trouble.
We've got Mark back on the line in Albuquerque. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Or not.
We do. We do. We have him. Can we get Mark on the line? Mark, good morning. Can you hear me?
Good morning, Elaine. Can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can. You're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, great. I have a general comment. I think that, like education and other systems that we have created in this country, the right people just aren't running it. We're allowing the healthcare system to be run by politicians, insurance companies, lawyers. But where are doctors? I don't see the AMA and doctors as a whole, as a profession, standing up and taking care of business. No one else is better suited to see how our healthcare system should be set up, how it should be run, and what services should be offered, and therefore to help control costs. They also need to stand up and police those in their profession who don't perform well, and they don't do a very good job of that. I'd really like to see the professions in charge of these things and these services, these necessary things, stand up and take care of business. I have a feeling that they would get popular support.
I don't have any doubt that what you just said is true.
Barbara?
I think that the issue that has come up a couple of times both by Mark and by Dr. Wallman is the issue that we have a lot of corporate interest who dominate, and their first line of business is to make a profit for their shareholders. And so that is why you have to balance it with the regulations and the consumer protections that have been put in place, because the industry is not going to self-regulate. We saw that with Wall Street in the disaster that just occurred that's put us in this incredible recession. I think that doctors certainly and other professionals can be part of that, but I think it's a broad system. I certainly agree that as we make the switch to control cost, it's going to be looking at coordinating care and documenting and coming up with those metrics for what the real health outcomes are for people, and knowing both for the consumer and for the healthcare system that people are actually coming out healthier. So this evidence-based practice that you see talked about a lot in the Affordable Care Act, I agree with Dr. Wallman, really needs to be underscored.
And yet, healthcare professionals are not automatically good bureaucrats, administrators, automatically, right? I mean, you want your pediatric cardiologist.
Definition.
You want your pediatric cardiologist to be really, really good at pediatric cardiology and to have them not have to worry about billing.
But there's a bigger issue, and it's really fundamental, and it's not just the corporate, but certainly I agree with Barbara. It is the fact that an organization, whether it's the government or a corporation, is looking for the welfare of the organization, but the doctor is looking for the welfare of the individual patient before him, not the corporate budget.
But what about the hospital? What about the doctor looking at the welfare of the hospital as an organization?
Well, firstly, we're not allowed to. We have every doctor by law has a financial separation between the hospital and us. But we're still in the situation where we should be paying for the outcomes that patients receive. If we were paying for that, it would change the entire structure of the system, and then we would align the money reward with the patient welfare.
Barbara, you're nodding your head.
I'll give you a good example of that. The last practice I managed was an OBGYN practice, and when you would think that the concern would be legal defensive medicine. That's not what I saw.
When you say defensive medicine, you mean preventative care? Or
No.
I mean that people assume, especially that OBs are going to be concerned about lawsuits.
Oh, getting
and then
sued.
They're practicing defensive.
Right. Liability.
Like doing everything you can to avoid some kind of a negative outcome that somebody could sue you for.
I worked in a great hospital. I had a great corp of doctors. But the reality was that for on-call practice, when you made your deliveries, there were three practices competing. And so if the person that you had given the prenatal care to for 9 months delivered on someone else's practice, they got the bulk of the payment. So what did people do? They induced patients 12 hours before. Mm-hmm. So you're going to deliver
get
on their
the
practice. And get the money. So, I don't know that doctors had a 42% induction rate. Now, in the United States, the ACOG, the Association of the OBGYN Professional Association, has said 4 or 5 years ago, so concerned about this, that you should not induce babies before 39 weeks. One out of nine babies is induced before 39 weeks, and most of them are not for medical reasons.
Let's take a few more calls. Carol in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Well, good morning, and this is such a great show. It's been very, very informative so far. Thank you very much for putting it together. Actually, the only problem I have is that I can't follow it quite as well. If you'd please not interrupt each other, it would be helpful, and I can follow what the person is trying to say. Anyway, my question maybe is more about local conditions rather than global or national ones, and that is if I or some of my friends have questions, often what we get is a link to whitehouse.gov or a link to some website. This doesn't often answer a specific personal question like why when I ask my doctor a question about mammograms or colonoscopy, they don't know whether I'm covered, and they refer me to the insurance company, and the insurance company says that's not covered, but it seems to me like it should be. So I guess my question is, if we have a specific local question about coverage, is there a real person that we can talk to?
Yes, you can call the Ombudsman at the Department of Insurance, and they should be able to help you with coverage questions and questions in general. Forthcoming, there's going to be a lot more consumer assistance, particularly as we move into that new market exchange, which will kind of level the playing field for individuals and small groups so that you have the same large group buying power that currently the larger groups have, and that will help bring down cost. But in that, there are going to be, I think, a lot more information available both on site. It'll be consumer-friendly, but there'll also be consumer assistance programs and navigators to help you answer questions, and especially as we go through the changes.
I'll coordinate with you, Barbara, after the show to post some of the links that you're mentioning on our website at KUNM.org. Let's take another call. John in Albuquerque. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. Listening to this discussion, I regret that we don't have single-payer health care. But my comment is, right now we're paying $700 a month, about $8,500 a year for a family of four for health insurance premiums, and then there's deductible and costs. And I thought I saw a plan that we could access through one of the providers here where you could basically just have a $5,000 or $6,000 deductible and then not pay any premiums, and you set up a health insurance savings account, which would be a hugely more favorable thing to us. But as a small business person, I found that we didn't qualify or couldn't access this, or that there were premiums involved. But is there anything like that where you can just put your money in a savings account if you're healthy and then not have to pay premiums and have a high deductible? Because that's one – I mean, this is killing us, these premiums.
They are the health savings accounts, and I think also in the individual market, you find a lot of the high deductible plans. Unfortunately, it leaves a lot of people underinsured. Some people can cover themselves during that high deductible period, but for a lot of people, they end up not getting care during the high deductible period because they simply can't access it. And I think once we get into the marketplace for small businesses and for the uninsured and individuals, you'll begin to see those prices come down. And I want to say one reason why prices are so high in New Mexico for premiums, because 1/4 of our population does not have access to health care. 1 out of 4 of our neighbors, out of our friends, New Mexicans, are uninsured without access to health care. As a result, on our insurance, those of us who do have insurance pay, on average, for a family of four, $2,300 a year in a surcharge to help cover that uncompensated care. If you're an individual, you pay about $830. A lot of us could put that $2,300 to good use for our family needs.
We've got an email comment from Gentina. She writes that she's disappointed with the disappearance of the public option in the U.S. healthcare health insurance discussion early on in this healthcare fight. And she writes that she's opposed to requiring people to buy health insurance. She says she's 60 and that she doesn't think that anyone will sell her affordable insurance, and that the administration of healthcare should be a nonprofit undertaking. Another comment from Martine on email. He wants to know what's so bad about a government program. He says with private insurance, he does not have the doctor of his choice because his company switched plans and his insurance won't pay for the prescription that he needs, and his deductions, or I think he means maybe his copays or his premiums, keep rising. These two comments from Gentina and Martine about structure and also about do either of you have responses to that or thoughts on that?
Well, we also are sorry that the public option plan didn't go through. But what did go through under the Affordable Care Act, and I'm really proud that New Mexico is one of the first 7 states to go for it and has actually been approved and received money for it, is called the Consumer Operated and Oriented Health Plan.
This is the co-op program,
This
right?
is the co-op program.
New Mexico just got funding to put
New
together
Mexico
this.
New Mexico is 1 of 7, and that will be a nonprofit, a consumer-run health care plan. And we're going to be very excited to see how that plays out, and the people running it are fabulous, and that's exciting.
What are your thoughts on the nonprofit co-op?
What we're doing is we are making a bizarrely complex system more complex, and as is obvious from my comment and my tone, I really oppose all of this. It's time for us to stop, for example, the distortion of the entire market by having health insurance deductible for organizations, but not for the individual. There was a reason for that back in the 40s, but it ceases to be valid and important. Why can't they compete for my dollars and let insurance companies and let me decide who I want to spend my money on? More importantly, where I want to spend my money. If we all had The United States spends now over $8,000 for every one of 330 million people a year, and most of them, we're not spending it on them, we're just spending it on the pool, if you will. Well, what if I had control and you had control and Barbara had control of our money, and we simply had, if you will, a large catastrophic, if you will. Nobody wants to get hit with a $100,000 bill. Nobody can afford it.
Well, you've mentioned earlier that you would like to see our whole kind of health insurance, health industry system kind of torn down and kind of revamped from the bottom up.
Correct.
In a new form. But I wonder, with a system as complicated as that which we have, and if the co-op is indeed adding to the complexity of it, how what would tearing down a system and building it back up from the foundation look like? How would that actually take place?
And I don't know how it would take place. No, that's not true. I do know how it would take. Until we as a nation say these are the basic principles that we think are important for healthcare. And the example I like to give for the books I've recently written, Uproot U.S. Healthcare, to show how to fix the system, I actually reviewed some of the founding documents for the United States. Well, we have a Bill of Rights. Nobody argues with the Bill of Rights. That is the founding governing principles. There are others down the road.
So is there like a healthcare option that you'd like to see added to the Bill of Rights?
No, what I want to see is a national dialogue of our people, organized literally federally, but thousands of town halls. So is healthcare a right? What does that mean? What does that mean to you? What does that mean to you? What should we do with illegal residents and undocumented illegal residents in our country? In the universal healthcare countries, they are non-people. They don't get care. My son, who lives abroad, is a non-entity in his country because he's not a citizen there. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. What I'm saying is we should agree on that. We should have a consensus, have a discussion, have a consensus and say, healthcare is a right, yes or no. What does that mean? Et cetera, et cetera.
We're talking about the Affordable Care Act today on the call-in show. The guests this morning you're hearing from Dr. Dean Waldman. He's a cardiologist and a founding board member of the Rio Grande Foundation. Also, Barbara Weber. She is executive director of Health Action New Mexico. We'll be right back after this break to take your calls.
Escuela del Sol, an independent not-for-profit Montessori school in downtown Albuquerque for children from 18 months to 6th grade, providing innovative teaching methods and academic excellence for over 40 years, empowering our children to lead the way. For more details, visit escueladelsol.org. A message from the tax-exempt Escuela del Sol.
This is Richard Town, General Manager of KUNM. For the first time in many years, we are giving you an opportunity to help us trim days off of the Spring On Air Pledge Drive by donating early, online, or by mail. So far, we're nearly halfway to our goal and have about a month to get there. We can do it if you respond to our letter that you got in February or go to KUNM.org today and chip in what you can. If less on-air fundraising sounds good to you, we're counting on you to help us make that possible. Thank you.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act. If you have comments about how the law has changed your healthcare situation here in New Mexico, give us a call. The number is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866 or send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org. You can also post your comments online at kunm.org. We got an email from Monica. She writes that she disagrees with Dr. Waldman's comments about evidence-based medicine. She writes that Jonathan Gruber, an MIT economics professor and architect of the Massachusetts healthcare reform, wrote a comic book about the Affordable Care Act that explains it really well. That's from Monica on email. We also got an email from Virginia, and she has a question. She wants to know how people will pay for the mandatory insurance in 2014 when they cannot currently afford insurance, and she says that she's an advocate of a single-payer system.
I think that one thing to know is to note is that for people who can't afford it, the whole idea is the Affordable Care Act. So there will be subsidies available for people, and they will go up to 400% of the poverty level. So for a family of four, that's about $80,000. And as you come down in that, where you fit in terms of your resources, the subsidies are larger. So if you were starting out, say, at 150% of the poverty level, you might be talking about an almost complete subsidy to be able to buy on the exchange.
Dean, you were shaking your head.
Well, we keep avoiding the fact that this is supposed to be the Affordable Care Act, and as a nation, this is being costed out now. The GOA just gave a new estimate at $1.76 trillion.
That's the Government Accountability Office.
And We couldn't afford health care the way it was before the ACA, and we can't afford the way it is – our money – sorry, let's not make this political – the way our money is being distributed. Bill Weiss is a colleague and a friend and a physician. He's actually a pediatrician who was in the Roundhouse about a bunch of years ago, and I'm surprised he got out alive when he said, and I quote, we have enough money in the healthcare system. It's just badly distributed. And what's happening, I see, is more and more money is going to the bureaucrats. Sorry to make this we they, but it is. The bureaucrats.
To the part of the system that's administrative as opposed to care.
To the people who are with patients. I mean, Medicare cuts reimbursements to physicians and to hospitals, and at the same time, six whole new agencies are created by the Affordable Care Act. Now, wait a minute. Seems to me that it should be the other way around.
A couple of comments. The Medicare reimbursement for physicians is a separate issue. It's gone on since forever. And I agree, it's a broken system. Every year we come to this end of the year drama where there's going to be a big cut mandated by the law unless the Congress reverses it, which they always do. So I agree that issue has to be fixed, but it's separate from the Affordable Care Act. I do think that you have to look at the fact that the kind of options that Dr. Wellman is talking about are actually there in the exchange process. People are going to have the option for a number of plans, including nonprofit plans. There'll be two federal plans, and congressmen have to buy their insurance now on the exchange.
Let's take a call. Daniel in Socorro. Good morning, Daniel. You're on the air.
Good morning. I would like to agree with the gentleman that health care, corporate profits shouldn't be a right, but health care should be. I still would like to see a model like Social Security. All my life I've paid into Social Security, and that's paid for older people who have retired, people whose father died, and to get them to 18 years old, and et cetera. And that's all my life. All my life I've also paid into insurance. While I was young, all that money went into company profits because I never collected. Now that I'm getting older, I'm going to go off that company and I'm going to go on to Medicare, which is where it's breaking the system. So if we all paid in, I think then there could probably be enough for the illegals that he's also talking about. So Social Security, all pay, all collect. Health insurance, all pay, all collect. Thank you.
So you're taking responsibility, and you're, of course, right. Of course, our government then took your money that you put into the Social Security system and replaced it with IOUs.
I think that what the person on the street in New Mexico is really up against is how to find the health care for their families. And for one out of four people, they don't have access to health care. And I think when you start talking about rights, and I wouldn't get into that discussion, but the fact is that you're more likely to die if you don't have insurance. We know that you're twice as likely to die before the age of 65 if you don't have insurance. And when there are deaths every year, 25% of those are people who don't have health insurance. They're 25% more likely to die in that particular year. So we have people dying literally because we do not have access to health care in New Mexico.
Let's take one last call this morning. Jim in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just have this comment. I think there's a much broader issue, and I think it's not just so much as an allocation of the funds that we have, because obviously we have enough money. But the larger implication is that I think that really the treatment modalities that we use, i.e. Pharmacotherapy, huge costs in the way that we treat individuals solely with drug therapy for their chronic conditions. That needs to change. I happen to be a pharmacist. I know what drugs cost. I know what they get sold for. There's a huge discrepancy there. And one of the issues that I think really needs to be just addressed is that if we're going to have the money for health care, what kind of health care are we paying for? For example, Institute of Safe Medicine Practices addressed this issue years ago, decades ago, practically, that we're over-treating people with medications, we're using them in ways that have never been used before. There's huge costs associated with that. That's in my view, that's what needs to change, and you folks really aren't addressing it today, so I'd like to hear your comments on it. Thank you.
Dean, I want to tag on a second question to Jim's question about kind of over-treatment. Things have changed over time. We're able to do a lot more for patients now than we were 100 years ago. I mean, you as a pediatric mm-hmm. cardiologist have a lot more at your fingertips with respect to therapies and treatments and surgeries that you can do with your tiny, tiny little patients.
Yeah.
Can you address this distinction sure. between over-treatment and the increase in cost of treatments that we are now able to do that are developments?
Systematically, the problem really, of course the caller is right, but the you can't solve it by more regulations and by trying to tell the patient or the doctor what to do. What we need to do is have what I call an aligned system. Example, we should get paid for my healthy baby after surgery as a reward for his health or her health. But right now, cheapest is best, and if cheapest is best, then the solution to a baby with congenital heart disease is to let him die.
Well, but under your proposal, if you know that a child is very, very risky and may or may not make it, doesn't that also add the impetus for somebody to say, we're not going to do this surgery on this child because this child's not going to survive and we're never going to get paid?
And that's why that leads me to the question or the response to the caller. The government here, or for that matter, and that's part of the IPAB, part of the Independent Payment Advisory Board, is the same thing as they have in Great Britain, which they have a different name for it. They think what is cost-effective for populations, and what we care about is what is cost-benefit for the individual patient. And those two sometimes are drastically different, and I want a system where I can say your baby is going to cost $125,000 for us to fix his heart. But at the end of that, we're going to have a normal, healthy, productive, contributing citizen 20, 30 years from now.
And I think Barbara. Some of the ways that the ACA gets at that is that it tries to look at, and I think what we will force the issue over the years as we go into it, is coordinated care. Right now we do not have coordinated care, and coordinated care can address some of those
issues.
What
does that mean exactly?
That means that particularly for your older population or anyone that has chronic illnesses, you may be going to 5 or 6 doctors, and there's no coordination. The hospital does coordinate with the network. I worked in a geriatric hospital. Let me tell you, we had a different formulary coming out than the formulary of most of their plans. And so people were coming out with dual medications. When they came out of the hospital, they took both and they got
got sick.
So they got sick from over medication. So there's so many examples of that in the system. And I think some of these what he calls agencies or the groups that are being set up are set up specifically to look at that. The other is to move to the changes in the payment process that the doctor's referring to, and those are in the ACA. And I think there's no known answers. We're going to have to pilot some of these, try them, see what works, look at the outcomes, and then keep moving.
I'd like to thank you both for joining us this morning. Dr. Dean Waldman is a cardiologist, a pediatric cardiologist, and he's also a foundation board member with the Rio Grande Foundation. Barbara Weber is executive director of Health Action New Mexico. Thanks to you both for joining us. If you missed part of this program, you can find it online at KUNM.org in about 10 minutes. I'll be posting the audio from this show. If you have comments about the show, suggestions for future show topics, feel free to email us at callinshow@KUNM.org. There is an online comment section at the bottom of the posting for all of the call-in shows. So if you have comments about the show that you'd like to share publicly with users of our website and KUNM listeners, that is another way to make comments and have them heard by listeners and KUNM people in the KUNM community. Next week, the U.S. Supreme Court will consider the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. It's going to be 3 days of arguments before the Supreme Court. We'll bring you special NPR coverage of what's at stake with the healthcare overhaul, as well as coverage of the arguments presented to the justices. That's Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evenings next week at 7 p.m. after All Things Considered here on KUNM. Thanks so much for joining us for the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be back next week at 8 o'clock on Thursday morning. I'm Elaine Baumgartel.